The following morning, he made a short trip to Zurich and opened an account in the Credit Suisse Bank, in which he deposited $6,000. Then he returned to Paris, where a makeup artist attached a bushy mustache to his face, a photographer took his pictures with his new glasses, and handed him a set of passport photos. Back in Rotterdam, he brought the photos to the visa clerk at the Brazilian consulate, and the tourist visa to Brazil was stamped in his Austrian passport. Now, he could buy his plane tickets to Rio de Janeiro, and from there, to Sao Paulo and Montevideo in Uruguay. Wherever he went, the loquacious Kunstler spoke of his flourishing business in Austria, the generous tips that he spread on his way, his choice of the best hotels and the most exclusive restaurants spoke for themselves. Kunstler, indeed, was a rich and successful businessman. By these seemingly simple actions, Mossad agent Yitzhak Sarid, not his real name, built a foolproof cover for himself. Somewhere between Paris, Rotterdam, and Zurich, Yitzhak Sarid evaporated into thin air, and a new man emerged in his stead. Anton Kunstler, an Austrian businessman, with an address in Rotterdam, bank accounts, business cards, a visa, and a plane ticket to Brazil. Only a few days earlier, on September 1st, Yitzhak Sarid had been summoned to a meeting in Paris. Sarid was a member of the Mossad operational team codenamed Caesarea. In a safe house on Avenue de Versailles, he met with Caesarea's commander, Yoska Yariv, a sturdy, muscular man admired by his subordinates. Yariv, a former army officer, had replaced Rafi Eitan as the head of the operational team. Eitan had been appointed head of Europe Station, based in Paris. Yariv started by saying that in a few months, the West German parliament would adopt a statute of limitations regarding war crimes, which meant that Nazi criminals, living now undercover, would be able to reemerge from hiding and resume normal lives as if they had never committed their atrocious acts. Yariv said that many Germans wanted to turn the page and leave Germany's horrid past behind them. Even other nations that had suffered under the Germans were not eager to keep searching for Nazi criminals. Since Eichmann's capture 4 years before, awareness about Nazi crimes had diminished, as if Eichmann's trial and execution had closed a chapter in the world's history. It was imperative, Yariv said, to make sure that the statute of limitations on Nazi crimes did not become law. The world needed to be reminded that monsters were still at large. "We should kill one of the greatest Nazi criminals," Yariv said to Sarid. And a Mossad agent on a mission in South America had found the one. The butcher of Riga, a Latvian Nazi, guilty of massacring 30,000 Jews, had been positively identified. He was living in Brazil under his real name, Herbert Zuckers. The Ramsad, Meir Amit, had given the green light for the operation. Yariv now turned to Sarid, and not only because of Sarid's record as a smart and resourceful agent who had participated in the Eichmann operation. He also knew Sarid was born in Germany, and both his parents had died in the Holocaust. Sarid had escaped to Palestine, but had sworn to fight Hitler and had been one of the first Palestinian volunteers in the British Army during the war. Yariv did not have to worry about Sarid's motivation. "I want you to build yourself a cover as an Austrian businessman," the Caesarea commander said to Sarid. "Your job will be to fly to Brazil, find Zuckers, and win his confidence. That is the first step toward his execution." In the detailed briefing that followed, Yariv gave Sarid his new name, Anton Kunstler. 10 days after the meeting in Paris, Anton Kunstler boarded a Varig plane to Rio de Janeiro. He was excited and yet troubled by his mission. He had never been in such a situation before. He had to operate completely alone in a foreign country, and try making friends with a monster with sharp senses who certainly expected that one day somebody would try to kill him. Kunzla knew well that a single mistake could cause the failure of the entire operation. Just one misstep could cost him his life. During the flight, Kunzla perused a voluminous file of documents, testimonies, and press cuttings about Herbert Zuckers. He had become famous in the 30s as a gifted and bold pilot who had flown from Latvia to Gambia in Africa in a small plane he had built with his own hands. Overnight, the young, handsome pilot had become a national hero in Latvia. He was awarded the International Santos Dumont Medal in honor of the Brazilian aviation pioneer. The press called him the Eagle of Latvia and the Latvian Lindbergh. The War Museum in Riga was assailed by multitudes eager to see Zuckers's plane on display there. Zuckers was a right-wing Latvian nationalist, yet he had many Jewish friends. He even traveled to Palestine and came back deeply impressed by the Zionists' achievements. His enthusiastic speeches about the pioneers in Palestine made him seem an ally to Latvian Jews. Yet, when World War II erupted, things suddenly changed. Latvia was first occupied by the Soviets, who quickly won the people's hatred and who persecuted those like Zuckers. But the Red Army retreated after Hitler's invasion of Russia, and Latvia was conquered by the German army. Zuckers now transformed completely. As staunch nationalist and a leader of the fanatic fascist organization Thunder Cross that volunteered to serve the Nazis, Zuckers became the most cruel and sadistic murderer of the Riga Jews. Early on, he and his soldiers herded 300 Jews into a local synagogue and set it on fire, murdering everyone inside. He arrested Jews, beat them to death with his revolver, shot hundreds of others, humiliated and killed Orthodox Jews, smashed babies' heads on the city walls. One night, he made a Jewish girl undress in front of a group of Jewish prisoners, then forced an old rabbi to stroke and lick her to the drunken laughter of the Latvian guards. In the summer, he ordered the drowning of 1,200 Jews in the Kuldiga Lake, and in November 1941, he led 30,000 Riga Jews to the killing field in the Rumbula forests, where they were undressed by German soldiers and shot in cold blood. Reading the depositions of some Jews who miraculously survived, Kunzla was deeply shocked. The documents in the file described Zuckers' flight to France with forged papers at the end of the war. Posing as a farmer, he managed to get on a boat bound for Rio de Janeiro. He took with him a strange insurance policy, a young Jewish girl, Miriam Keitzner, whom he had protected during the war. Miriam, who served as his champion now, was speaking throughout Brazil about her noble savior from Riga. In Rio, Zuckers quickly established warm relations with many Brazilian Jews. He loved describing to his audiences Miriam's fascinating story. "The Nazis caught her in Latvia," he used to say. "She was to die a horrible death, but I saved her, risking my life." Such a valiant hero and a savior of Jews didn't come to Rio every day, and the city Jews did their best to show the brave Latvian how much they valued his noble deeds. Zuckers became very popular in the Jewish community, till the night when the brave Latvian had too much to drink. The alcohol loosened his tongue, and the inebriated Zuckers told now a very different story to his audience. He spoke of Jews, indeed, but now he called them pigs and scum. He spoke with enthusiasm of the means he and his Nazi friends had used to slaughter the Jews of Europe, of Jews who were burned, drowned, shot, and beaten to death. The Latvians' Jewish friends were stupefied. They started investigating, and the results of their research were horrifying. When his real identity was exposed, Zuckers vanished. He didn't leave Rio, only moved to a distant neighborhood of the sprawling city. He abandoned Miriam Keitzner, whom he didn't need anymore. Miriam would later marry a local Jew and assimilate in the Brazilian society. As for Zuckers, he brought over his wife and three sons. 10 years went by. Zuckers had become the respected owner of the air taxi company. But then, by chance, he was discovered again by the Rio Jewish community. They marched to raise public awareness. Students broke into the air taxi offices, smashed windows, destroyed equipment, and emptied files. Zuckers left Rio with his family right away and settled in Sao Paulo. Even though nobody bothered him there, Zuckers felt he was still in danger. He was haunted by fears and suspected every approaching stranger. In June 1960, a few days after Eichmann's capture, Zuckers came to police headquarters in Sao Paulo and asked for police protection. His request was granted, but it was also publicized in the media, and relatives of Zuckers's victims all over the world now knew where he lived. As years passed, Zuckers's fears only grew. He told his wife and sons that Jewish avengers could discover his whereabouts and come to murder him at any time. He even prepared a list of his most dangerous enemies, most of them important Brazilian Jews from Rio. At the top of the list were Dr. Aharon Steinbruch, a senator, Dr. Alfredo Gartenberg, Dr. Marcus Constantino, Dr. Israel Skolnikov, Mr. Klinger, Mr. Pyritsky. Zuckers kept his real name, but built his houses like fortresses and apparently paid substantial bribes for protection by the police and the security services. He launched several business ventures, but they all failed. According to Kunzla's file, his last address was a marina on an artificial lake outside Sao Paulo. Zuckers used to rent a few boats and take tourists on aerial promenades over the city in his seaplane. Kunzla knew well that if he tried to approach Zuckers directly, he would certainly arouse his suspicions. So first, he spent a few days in Rio. His stay in the stunning Brazilian city stood in sheer contrast to the dark mission he had undertaken. He walked on the Copacabana and Ipanema beaches, staring at mulatto beauties in minimal bikinis, gazed at the breathtaking Sugarloaf and the huge statue of Christ on top of the Corcovado, watched a macumba, the Brazilian voodoo ceremony, absorbed the warm sunshine and the rhythms of samba. He was a typical tourist, but he got acquainted with several senior officials and private investors in the tourism business, met with the local minister of tourism, and introduced himself as an investor interested in tourist enterprises in Brazil. He got a few letters of recommendation to major figures in the tourism business in Sao Paulo. Kunzla arrived in Sao Paulo and immediately found Zuckers's marina. By the pier, a little apart from the pleasure boats, he saw an old seaplane, and beside it, a tall, lean man wearing a pilot's overalls. Herbert's Zuckers. Kunzla approached the pretty German girl who sold tickets for Zuckers's boat excursions and asked her for information about tourism in that area. He didn't know then that the young woman was the wife of Zuckers's oldest son. She admitted she didn't know very much about tourism, but pointed at the man in the overalls. "Ask him, he will help you." Kunzla walked to the pilot and introduced himself as an Austrian investor. He asked a few professional questions, and Zuckers reluctantly answered. But his attitude changed when Kunzla asked to hire him and his plane for a tour over the city. A few minutes later, they were high in the air. The two men had a long, friendly chat. Kunzla knew how to make friends. On their return, Zuckers invited him to his boat for a shot of brandy. While they were drinking, Zuckers suddenly erupted in a furious diatribe against his accusers. "I was a war criminal," he shouted. "I saved a Jewish girl during the war." Kunzla suspected that Zucker's indignation was fake, and the Latvian only wanted to provoke his reaction. "Did you serve in the war?" Zucker's asked. "Yes," Kunzla said, "on the Russian front." But the tone of his answer seemed to indicate the opposite, to imply that Kunzla had served in the army, but certainly not on the Russian front. He also unbuttoned his shirt and showed Zucker's a chest scar. "From the war," he said, without elaborating. Kunzla made a quick assessment of his host. Zucker's was in a bad economic situation. The frayed overalls, the ramshackle plane, the sorry state of the boats, all of which indicated a low standard of living. Kunzla realized that he had to make Zucker's believe that he, Kunzla, was his chance to overcome his troubles. He was the man who could bring him large profits. He therefore kept talking about his company and his partners and their grandiose projects to invest a lot of money in tourism in Latin America. He hinted that Zucker's could perhaps join their group, as he knew the Brazilian tourist scene well. Zucker's seemed interested in his guest's words, but Kunzla suddenly got on his feet. "Well," he said, "I shouldn't be bothering you anymore. You must be very busy." "No, not at all," Zucker's said, and suggested that Kunzla come to his home one of these days after work, so that we could discuss our common interests. The contact was established. The bait was cast. Now, Zucker's should be persuaded to swallow it. That evening, Kunzla dispatched a coded telegram to Yoska Yariv. For the first time, he used the code name that Yariv had chosen for Zucker's, the deceased. Zucker's, too, did some writing that night. He took the list of his most dangerous enemies and added another name to it. Anton Kunzla. A week later, a taxi stopped by a house in the Riviera neighborhood in Sao Paulo. The house was modest, but protected like a fortress. It was surrounded by a wall and barbed wire. The entrance was barred by an iron gate, and beside it stood a young man and a fierce-looking dog. Kunzla asked the youngster, who turned out to be one of Zucker's sons, to inform the pilot of his arrival. Zucker's welcomed him warmly, walked him through the house, introduced him to his wife, Milda, then pulled out a drawer and showed Kunzla about 15 medals from the war days. Many of them were adorned by a swastika. Zucker's opened another drawer and showed the amazed Kunzla his private armory, 3 heavy revolvers and a semi-automatic rifle. Zucker's proudly revealed that the Brazilian Secret Service had given him permits for all these weapons. "I know how to defend myself," he added. Kunzla took Zucker's words as a veiled threat. "If you try to hurt me," his host seemed to say, "you should know that I am armed and dangerous." Zucker's suddenly had an idea. "Why don't you come with me on a trip to my farms? They are in the country. We can spend a night there." Kunzla readily agreed, but on his way to his hotel, he stopped at a hardware store and bought a switchblade, just in case. A few days later, the two of them got into Kunzla's rented car and headed for the mountains. It was an eerie, tense trip. Here was Anton Kunzla, armed only with a knife, fearing Zucker's and yet determined to tempt him with the prospects of easy money and lead him to his death. And sitting in the car beside him was Herbert Zucker's, strong, sober, but poor, suspicious of his new friend, armed with a heavy handgun, but unable to resist the bait Kunzla was dangling before him. Kunzla thought that perhaps he was the victim in this cat-and-mouse game. Perhaps Zucker's did not believe his cover story. Perhaps he was taking him to the mountains to murder him there? Along the way, they visited a neglected farm. All of a sudden, Zucker's drew his semi-automatic rifle out of his bag. Kunzla started. Why did Zucker's bring over both a handgun and a rifle? "What about a shooting contest?" Zucker's asked him. Kunzla understood right away. Zukers wanted to test his abilities as a former fighter on the Russian front and see if he knew how to shoot. The Latvian fixed a paper target to a tree, loaded his rifle, and fired 10 bullets in rapid succession. The hits formed a cluster 10 centimeters in diameter. Zukers took from his bag a second paper target, loaded the rifle again, and handed it to Kunzla. A veteran of the British Army and the IDF, Kunzla was an excellent marksman. He picked up the weapon and without any delay fired 10 bullets, making a cluster of 3 centimeters. Zukers nodded with approval. "Excellent, Herr Anton," he said. The two of them got back in the car and traveled to a second farm. It was much larger and included a dense forest and a river where alligators lazily lingered. Zukers led the way into the forest, and Kunzla again was assailed by fears. Was this a trap? Did Zukers bring him here so he could murder him without leaving evidence? He kept walking at Zukers' side. All of a sudden, he stepped on a rock. A nail got loose in his shoe and deeply punctured his heel. Doubling over in pain, Kunzla kneeled and removed his shoe. Blood was dripping from a wound in his heel. Zukers bent over him and drew his gun. Kunzla was exposed, completely defenseless. That's it, he thought. His last moment had arrived. The Latvian would shoot him as a dog. But Zukers handed him the gun. Use the butt, he said. Hammer it down. Kunzla took the gun. All of a sudden, the roles were reversed. They were all alone in a mountain farm. There was not a living soul for miles around. The gun was loaded. He could terminate Zukers that very moment. Just point the gun and press the trigger. Instead, he bent down and forcefully pounded the nail's sharp end, then returned the gun to its owner. At nightfall, the two of them reached a ramshackle hut and improvised dinner with some food they had brought with them. They spread their sleeping bags on 2 old iron beds. Kunzla saw Zukers slipping his gun under his pillow. Troubled by ominous thoughts, he pulled his knife out of his pocket and held it ready, but he couldn't sleep. In the middle of the night, he heard a noise coming from Zukers' bed. The Nazi got up, took his gun, and quietly stepped out. Why? Kunzla thought. He tried to listen to the sounds outside, and suddenly he heard an easily recognizable noise. Zukers was standing outside and urinating. There were probably wild animals prowling around. The following day, they returned, safe and sound, to Sao Paulo. Kunzla let out a sigh of relief when he walked into his hotel. During the following week, Kunzla invited Zukers to gourmet restaurants, expensive nightclubs, and bars. He noticed Zukers' hungry stare and realized that it had been years since the man last tasted all those pleasures that money could buy. His next move was to ask Zukers to join him in several domestic flights, on Kunzla's expense account, of course. They visited some major tourist locations, and Zukers enjoyed the best food and lodging. Now, Kunzla suggested that they flew to Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay. His partners, he said, wanted to establish their South American business center there, and he wanted to check the availability of office buildings and other facilities. He even paid for Zukers' new passport. Kunzla flew to Montevideo, and a few days later, Zukers joined him. But the Latvian's suspicions had not faded away. He had brought his camera. As he came out of the plane in Montevideo Airport, he saw Kunzla, who was waiting for him. Zukers took out his camera and snapped several photos of Kunzla, catching him by surprise. His friend, his partner, and his funder had become, in Zukers' eyes, the major suspect in a plot to assassinate him. In the meantime, Kunzla had rented a big American car. He was quite embarrassed by its color, shocking pink, but that was the only car available at the rental agency. He also had reserved rooms for both of them in the best hotel in town, the Victoria Plaza. They spent a few days in Montevideo looking for a building that could serve as headquarters for Kunzler's company. They didn't find a place, but enjoyed a dreamlike vacation. Again, Kunzler invited Zukers to the best restaurants, took him to nightclubs, on sightseeing tours, to the casino, where he shared his winnings with his guest. Zukers was delighted. Finally, they parted, and Kunzler left for Europe, after promising Zukers he would be back in a few months to continue developing their project. Zukers went back to Sao Paulo, but told his wife that in Montevideo somebody had been following him, so now he had to stay alert and be ready to defend himself. In Paris, Kunzler again met Yariv and his friends, and they immediately started to prepare the operation. It was decided that Zukers would be executed in Montevideo for a few reasons. In Brazil, Zukers was protected by the local police, and that could create some problems. In Brazil, the large Jewish community was vulnerable to attacks by neo-Nazis or Germans seeking revenge. And finally, Brazil still had the death penalty, and if a hit team was caught and tried, they could be killed. The hit team consisted of 5 agents and was headed by Yoska Yariv himself. One of the agents was Ze'ev Amit Slutsky, a cousin of the Ramsad Meir Amit. The other members were Kunzler, Ari Cohen, not his real name, and Eliezer Sudit, Sharon, who also got an Austrian passport in the name of Oswald Tausig. The team members arrived in Montevideo in February 1965. Oswald Tausig rented a green Volkswagen. He also rented a small house, the Casa Cubertini, on Cartagena Street, in the Carrasco neighborhood. At the last moment, Yariv charged him with a chilling task, to buy a large trunk, like the travel trunks that were used in the 19th century. The trunk would be used as a makeshift coffin for the Nazi's body when the operation was over. Kunzler invited Zukers to Montevideo again. On February 15, 1965, Zukers went to police headquarters and was received by an officer, Alcido Sintra Buenofilo. "I am a businessman," the Latvian said. "For several years I've been under the protection of the Brazilian police because I have good reason to fear for my life. Now a European business partner is asking me to travel to Montevideo to meet him. What do you think? Can I travel to Uruguay? Isn't it risky?" "Don't go," the officer firmly said. "Here you live in peace because we protect you. But don't forget, the moment you leave Brazil, you aren't protected anymore. You expose yourself to your enemies. And if you've got enemies, I assume that they haven't forgotten you." Zukers thought a while, seemed to hesitate, but finally got up and said, "I was always a brave man. I am not afraid. I know how to defend my life. I always carry a gun, and believe me, in spite of all the years that have passed, I am still a fine shot." Kunzler met Zukers in Montevideo on February 23rd. The trap was set. Kunzler drove Zukers in a rented black Volkswagen toward the Casa Cubertini, where the hit team was waiting. On the way, they stopped several times to check some other houses that could serve as an office for the company. Finally, they reached the Casa Cubertini. They saw some men at work repairing the neighboring house. Tausig's green car, also a Volkswagen, was parked by the house. Kunzler turned off the engine, got out of the car, and walked purposefully toward the door. Zukers followed him. Kunzler opened the door and saw a terrifying sight. In the dark house, the members of the hit team stood by the walls, wearing only their drawers. They knew they couldn't overcome Zukers without a bloody fight and had undressed so their clothes wouldn't be soiled by his blood. There was something appalling in that sight of a group of people in drawers waiting in the dark for their victim. Kunzler moved aside and Zukers entered the house. As soon as he stepped in, Kuntzla slammed the door behind him. Three men leaped on Zucker's. Ze'ev Amit tried to grab him by the throat, as he had been trained in Paris. The others jumped him from both sides. The Latvian fought back. He succeeded in shaking off his attackers and made for the door. He yanked the door handle, then tried to draw the gun he was carrying in his pocket, while shouting in German, "Lassen Sie mich sprechen!" Let me speak. During the fight, Yariv tried to cover Zucker's mouth with his hand to prevent him from shouting. Zucker's fiercely bit his hand and almost tore off one of Yariv's fingers. Yariv cried in pain. At that moment, Amit grabbed a heavy construction hammer and landed a blow on Zucker's head. Blood spurted from the wound. The bodies of the attackers and their victim turned into a convulsing heap on the floor, while Zucker's desperately tried to draw his gun. It was a matter of seconds. Ari pressed his gun to Zucker's head and fired twice. The silencer muffled the sound of the shots. Zucker's body collapsed. His blood flowed on his clothes and the floor tiles. The hit team members were covered with blood. Oswald Tausig hurried to the yard and turned on the main water pipe. His friends washed the blood off their bodies, then cleaned the floor and the walls. Yet some large bloodstains remained on the house tiles. One of the members of the hit team claimed afterward that their intention had been to capture Zucker's alive and make him stand for an improvised court-martial before executing him. But flawed planning or a gross underestimation of the Latvian's physical strength turned the mission into a repulsive bloodbath that was unplanned and unnecessary. The Mossad agent had rented the house on Cartagena Street at the very last moment. The travel trunk was bought at the last moment as well. Instead of jumping their victim in their drawers, the Mossad agents could have shot him right away. But, as some of the hit team members told us, the mission was accomplished. The agents placed Zucker's body in the trunk to make the police believe that they intended to abduct him and smuggle him out of Uruguay. Then they left a typewritten letter in English on the body, which had been prepared beforehand. Considering the gravity of the crimes of which Herbert Zucker's was accused, notably his personal responsibility in the murder of 30,000 men, women, and children, and considering the terrible cruelty shown by Herbert Zucker's in carrying out his crimes, we condemned this said Zucker's to death. The accused was executed on February 23, 1965, by those who will never forget. The team left the building and departed in the two rented Volkswagens. In the neighboring house, the workmen kept pounding and hammering. They had not heard a thing. Yariv suffered terrible pain in his hand. Till his death, he wouldn't be able to properly use one of his fingers. Tausig and Kuntzla returned the cars and left their hotels. The entire team left Montevideo and went back by complex routes to Europe and to Israel. Ze'ev Amit returned to Paris, wounded in his body and hurt in his soul. Terrible nightmares haunted him for many months, and he couldn't overcome his shock and pain. When all the hit team members had left Latin America, a Mossad agent called the news agencies in Germany and reported the execution of a Nazi criminal in Montevideo by those who will never forget. The reporters who got the message discarded it right away, believing it was a prank. Seeing that nothing happened, the Mossad agents prepared a much more detailed and credible message and dispatched it to the news agencies and to a reporter in a Montevideo newspaper, who alerted the police. On March 8th, more than 10 days after Zucker's was killed, the police finally arrived at Casa Cubertini. The next day, the world press announced, in banner headlines, the discovery of Zucker's body in an empty house in Montevideo. In the media reports, two names were singled out as suspects in the killing, Anton Kuntzla and Oswald Tausig. A few days later, a Rio de Janeiro weekly published a huge photo of Anton Kunzla that had been taken by Zuckers. The magazine called Kunzla the smiling Austrian. The photo was reproduced on the front page of the Israel newspaper Ma'ariv. Some friends of the Mossad agent immediately identified Anton Kunzla. After a few more days, a letter arrived to Zuckers' house. It was a rather poor effort by Anton Kunzla to cover his tracks. "My dear Herberts, with God's help and that of some of our compatriots, I have safely reached Chile. I am now resting after a tiring journey, and I am sure that you, too, will very soon be back home. Meanwhile, I've discovered that we were followed by two people, a man and a woman. We must be very careful and take every precaution. As I've always said, you are running a great risk in working and traveling under your own name. It could be disastrous for us, and also lead to my real identity being discovered. So I hope that the complications in Uruguay have taught you a lesson for the future, and that you'll be more prudent now. If you notice anything suspicious in or around your house, remember the advice I gave you. Go and hide among von Leitze's men, a Nazi leader who had escaped to Cairo with a group of German exiles, for a year or two, until the question of an amnesty is settled. When you get this letter, reply to the address you know of in Santiago, Chile. Yours, Anton K. The letter, of course, did not fool anybody. Zuckers' wife Milda was adamant. Kunzla was the murderer. Most of the participants in the Zuckers killing are dead. Ze'ev Amit, whom the authors of this book knew well, was killed in the Yom Kippur War in 1973. Their mission paid off. The parliaments of Germany and Austria rejected the statute of limitation on the Nazi crimes. Years later, former Ramsad Isser Harel called one of the authors of this book and told him that a good friend of his wanted to meet. He didn't give any details, just an address in North Tel Aviv. The author found there a neat little house. A sturdy, bald man wearing glasses opened the door. The author recognized him right away. He said to the man, "Guten Abend, Herr Kunzler." Chapter 12. The Quest for the Red Prince. On September 5, 1972, at 4:30 a.m., eight armed terrorists wearing ski masks broke into the apartment of the Israeli team at the Munich Olympics. They killed Moshe Weinberg, the coach of the wrestling team who tried to bar their way, and Joe Romano, a weightlifting champion. A few athletes, awakened by the shouts and the gunfire, escaped by jumping out the windows. Nine were taken hostage by the terrorists. The German police arrived, followed by reporters, photographers, and television crews that covered the drama unfolding in the Olympic Village. For the first time in history, the whole world watched a murderous terrorist attack in live broadcast on its television screens. So too did Golda Meir, Israel's prime minister, who was awakened by her military adjutant. Golda felt trapped. The attack happened in a friendly country, and the responsibility for rescuing the hostages fell on Germany's shoulders. The authorities of the state of Bavaria, where the attack had occurred, politely rejected Israel's suggestion to send over Sayeret Matkal, the best Israeli commando unit. "You have nothing to worry about," the Germans said to the Israeli representatives. "We shall free all the hostages." But Germany lacked the experience, the creativity, and the courage to face a deadly, cunning terrorist organization. After an exhausting negotiation between the terrorists and the German authorities, which lasted a whole day, the terrorists and the hostages were driven to Fürstenfeldbruck Airport, outside Munich. There, the Germans had promised the terrorists they would board a plane that would take them to the destination of their choice. But the police actually had laid a childish and amateurish trap at the airport. They had hauled an empty and unmanned Lufthansa aircraft to the center of the airport. Incompetent sharpshooters had been placed on the roofs. The terrorists' leader came to inspect the plane. That plane, with no aircrew, its engines cold, was going to take off in a few minutes? The terrorists right away realized they were being deceived. They opened fire and threw hand grenades. During the ensuing shootout with the police, they murdered all the hostages. A German police officer was also killed, as well as 5 of the 8 terrorists. The other 3 would be captured, but released shortly afterward, following the hijacking of a Lufthansa aircraft by the terrorist organization. Israeli General Tzvi Zamir, who had recently replaced Meir Amit as Ramsad, helplessly watched the bloody drama from the control tower. He had been sent to Munich by Prime Minister Golda Meir, but had no right to interfere with the German operation. His hosts kept assuring him that their plan was excellent, and he just had to watch and see. What the Ramsad saw was the massacre of the Israeli athletes. He now realized that Israel had a new enemy, a terrorist organization that called itself Black September. Black September. That was how the Palestinian terrorists had renamed September 1970, the month when King Hussein of Jordan had massacred thousands of them in his kingdom. In the years that had passed since the 1967 Six-Day War, the terrorists gradually had gained control over large chunks of Jordanian territory and many neighborhoods in the capital, Amman. Towns and villages along the Israeli border became their exclusive bases, and they would wander in their streets with their weapons. They rejected King Hussein's authority, and step by step had become the real masters of Jordan. The king knew this, but didn't do anything. In one of his visits to an army camp, he saw a brassiere flying like a flag from a tank antenna. "What's this?" he angrily inquired. "This means that we are women," the male tank commander replied. "You don't let us fight." Finally, Hussein could take that no more. He could not continue burying his head in the sand like an ostrich while his kingdom was slipping through his fingers. On September 17, 1970, the king unleashed his army against the terrorist bases and camps. It was a terrible massacre. Terrorists were shot in the streets, hunted, captured, and executed without trial. Some of them found shelter in the Palestinian refugee camps, but the Jordanian artillery shelled the camps without a shadow of remorse, killing thousands. Scores of panicked terrorists crossed the Jordan River and surrendered to the Israeli army. They preferred to rot in Israeli prisons than die by Jordanian guns. During the massacre, most of the surviving terrorists escaped to Syria and Lebanon. Until this very day, the number of dead terrorists in Black September remains unknown. The figures are between 2,000 and 7,000 people. Yasser Arafat, chief of Fatah, the major Palestinian terrorist organization, became obsessed with revenge. He created, inside the Fatah, a secret inner organization, an underground within an underground. The regular Fatah members and commanders didn't even know of its existence. He called it Black September. This organization did not comply with the respectable lines of conduct that Arafat now tried to impose on his group in order to achieve international recognition and sympathy. It was to be a cruel, unrestrained group that would attack the enemies of the Palestinian people in every possible way, without mercy. Formally, Black September did not exist, and Arafat would deny any connection to it, but secretly, he was its creator and leader. He appointed Abu Yusuf, one of the senior Fatah commanders, as the head of Black September. As chief of operations, he selected Ali Hassan Salameh, a young man with fanatic views but no less brave or smart. Ali was the son of Hassan Salameh who had been the last supreme commander of the Palestinian forces during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. Hassan Salameh had been killed in battle, and his son Ali had vowed to continue his father's struggle. Black September's first operations didn't worry Israel too much, as they were mostly directed against Jordan. The terrorists bombed the Rome offices of the Jordanian National Airline, attacked the Jordanian embassy in Paris with Molotov cocktails, hijacked a Jordanian airliner to Libya, sabotaged the Jordanian embassy in Berna, an electronics plant in Germany, and oil reservoirs in Hamburg and Rotterdam. In the cellar of a house in Bonn, they murdered 5 Jordanian secret agents. In their most appalling operation, they murdered former Jordanian Prime Minister Wasfi Al-Tal in the lobby of the Cairo Sheraton. One of the assassins crouched over the body and lapped his victim's blood. With Israel's victory in the 1967 Six-Day War, the terrorists now took upon themselves to continue the war against the Jewish state. They hijacked aircraft, crossed Israel's borders, and assassinated civilians, planted bombs and explosive charges in the big cities. The Shabak and the Mossad had to fight a new enemy now, penetrate the terrorist organizations, foil their plans, and arrest their activists. Fatah was the major organization Israel had to confront now. Black September was not. But Black September soon crossed the limits it had originally set to its activities and started acting against Western nations, first and foremost, against Israel. The Munich massacre was their first bloody assault. And that was how Ali Hassan Salameh earned his nickname. He was the brains behind the Munich operation. The rumors about his obsession with killing and blood spread among the terrorists, and they started calling Hassan Salameh's son the Red Prince. In early October 1972, two retired generals asked to meet with Prime Minister Golda Meir, who had replaced Levi Eshkol after his sudden death in 1969. They were the new Ramsad, Tzvi Zamir, and the Prime Minister's advisor on counterterrorism, former Amman chief Aharon Yariv. Golda Meir had been utterly traumatized by Munich night, when the Israeli athletes had been murdered. "Once again, bound and tied Jews are being murdered on German soil," she had said. Golda was a strong, tough woman. It was clear that she wouldn't let the Munich massacre go without punishment. That was exactly what Zamir and Yariv came to propose. Tzvi Zamir, skinny, balding, and freckled, with sharp features jutting out of a triangular face, was a former Palmach fighter, but was not regarded as an outstanding general. The highest position he had reached during his military service was commander of the Southern Front. He later served as military attaché and representative of the Israeli Ministry of Defense in Great Britain. In 1968, he was appointed Ramsad to replace Meir Amit, who had completed his term. Many criticized Zamir's appointment. He was a bland and shy man with no experience in secret operations. Lacking charisma, he didn't consider himself the Mossad chief like Harel and Amit before him. He preferred to act as a sort of chairman of the board and delegated authority to many of his senior aides. He would achieve his fame only in the Yom Kippur War, see Chapter 14, but in 1972 he couldn't claim any substantial success. And some of the veteran agents of the Mossad, like Rafi Eitan, disliked him and left the service in protest. Yariv, like Zamir, was more a man in the background than a man of limelight. He had been an outstanding Amman chief during the Six-Day War, but he was admired mostly because of his learned, analytical mind. Slim, soft-spoken, bespectacled, with a clear forehead, the well-mannered Yariv looked more like an erudite professor than a master spy. Yariv and Zamir had a lot in common. They were supposed to be rivals because of their overlapping functions, yet they worked in harmony and mutual trust. They both were quiet, low-key, reserved, and rather shy. They hated to take center stage and were very cautious in their analyses and planning. But the idea they presented to Golda that October afternoon was surprisingly brutal. The Secret Services would identify and locate the Black September leaders and kill them. All of them. Since Munich, Yariv and Zamir had engaged in feverish activity and had gathered top-notch intelligence about Black September. They came to Golda prepared. Black September, they said, intended to launch an all-out war against Israel. This was a group that had sworn to kill as many Jews as possible, military, civilians, women, and children. The only way to stop it was to kill all its leaders, one after the other. Crush the snake's head. Golda hesitated. It was not easy for her to make a decision that would mean sending young people to a risky assassination campaign. Israel had never done that before. She sat quiet for a long time. Then she started speaking in a barely audible voice, as if she were talking to herself. She mentioned the horrid memory of the Holocaust and the tragic march of the Jewish people through the ages, always persecuted, hunted, and massacred. Finally, she raised her head and looked at Yariv and Zamir. "Send the boys," she said. Zamir immediately started preparing the operation. He called it Wrath of God. But Golda, too, had her say. As a prime minister of a democratic Jewish state, Golda could not rely only on the promise of Yariv and Zamir that the boys would hurt no one but the leaders and the major militants of Black September. Promises were not enough. She knew well that such an operation would be outside the law, and that if the civilian supervision of Mossad's actions was loosened, there was a real danger that innocent people might also be killed. Therefore, she decided to establish a tight control over Wrath of God. She created a secret committee that included, besides her, Minister of Defense Moshe Dayan and Deputy Prime Minister Yigal Alon, a brilliant former general. The three of them became a secret tribunal that had to review and approve every individual case in the operation. They were called the X Committee. Yariv and Zamir had to submit every file and name to the trio, and only after getting their approval could the Mossad hit team enter the scene. Masada, Caesarea, the operational department of the Mossad, was assigned to carry out Wrath of God. It was headed by Mike Harari, a black-haired, rugged, and secretive agent. Almost all the hits were to be carried out in Europe, where Black September had deployed its men, and where they were protected by sophisticated covers. Harari picked his men from Kidon, the Masada operational team. Each unit sent against a Black September operative was composed of several secondary crews. A crew of six men and women would be charged with identifying and following the suspects. They had to make sure that the man they targeted was indeed the right one, the wolf in sheep's clothing. They would arrive in the city where the suspect terrorist operated, follow him, secretly photograph him, learn his habits, locate his friends, find his exact address, the bars and restaurants he visited, his routine, hour by hour. A smaller unit, in most cases just a man and a woman, was in charge of the logistics, renting apartments, hotel rooms, and cars. Another small crew was in charge of communications with the advanced operational headquarters established in the respective European cities and with the Mossad headquarters in Israel. The hit team itself consisted of several Mossad agents who were the last to arrive on the ground. Their task was to get to a certain address at a certain time and kill the man whose photograph and other identifying details had been given to them. While they operated in the targeted city, they were protected by another team, a crew of armed agents and drivers who were positioned nearby, with vehicles ready to move and escape routes designed and rehearsed. Their task was to protect, with weapons if necessary, the members of the HIT team. Immediately after the operation was over, all HIT team members and their security details would leave the country. The crew that identified and followed the suspect would have left the country before the operation. The others would stay a few more days to cover up the traces, pack equipment, and return rental cars used for the operation. The first city chosen for a Wrath of God operation was Rome. In the Eternal City, the advance team identified and followed a man who could never be suspected of terrorism, a low-level clerk in the Libyan embassy, a Nablus-born 38-year-old Palestinian, Wael Zwitter. He was slim, gentle, and soft-spoken, the son of a well-known man of letters and translator into Arabic. Wael himself was known for his excellent translation of fiction and poetry into and from Arabic. He also was a devoted art lover. He worked as an interpreter at the Libyan embassy for the meager salary of 100 Libyan dinars a month, led a very modest life, and lived in a tiny apartment on Piazza Anibaliano. His friends knew him as a moderate man who rejected any form of violence and often expressed his disgust toward terrorism and killing. But even Zwitter's closest friends were not aware of his secret. Their good friend was a cruel fanatic who commanded the Black September operations in Rome with ruthless determination. Recently, he had devised and carried out a lethal operation. He identified two young English women who spent the first days of their vacation in Rome before continuing to Israel. Zwitter instructed two young, handsome, and charming Palestinians to establish contact with the girls and try to seduce them. And indeed, soon the young Casanovas landed in the English women's beds. When parting from their lovers, one of the Palestinians asked his girl to take a small record player with her, a gift for his family on the West Bank. The silly girl readily agreed, and the record player was duly checked with the lady's other luggage at the El Al counter in Rome's airport. They did not know that Zwitter and their charming lovers were sending them to their death. Under Zwitter's supervision, the Black September agents had taken the record player apart, stuffed it with explosives, then repacked it in a brand new box. The booby trap device was programmed to explode as soon as the aircraft reached its cruising altitude. The plane and all its passengers were doomed. Fortunately, the terrorists did not know that after a Swiss airliner headed for Israel had been blown up by a similar device, the storage compartments of El Al's planes had been covered with thick armor plate so that no explosion could wreck the aircraft. The record player did explode, but the blast was contained by the armor. The El Al pilot, alerted by a flashing red light, immediately returned to the airport. The stunned English girls were interrogated and revealed their involvement with their Palestinian lovers, but those two had left Italy right after they bid a heartbreaking farewell to the girls they were sending to their deaths. The first crews of the HIT team arrived in Rome and followed Zwitter for several days. A young couple strolled in front of the Libyan embassy, and the woman clicked a camera concealed in her handbag every time Zwitter went in or out of the embassy. Some tourists arrived in Rome by various flights. One of them, a 47-year-old Canadian by the name of Anthony Hutton, rented an Avis car and told the clerk he was staying at the Excelsior Hotel on Via Veneto. If the clerk had checked the information, he would have found that no such person was staying at the Excelsior, exactly like some other tourists who had rented cars that same week and given false addresses to the car rental agencies. On the night of October 16th, Zwitter returned home and was about to put a 10 lira coin in the elevator slot. The house entrance was dark, and somebody on the third floor was playing a melancholy tune on the piano. Suddenly, two men emerged from the shadows and pumped 12 22-gauge Beretta bullets in Zweiter's body. Nobody heard the shots. The two agents jumped into a Fiat 125 parked on the Plaza Anibaliano. A few hours later, they were out of the country. Now that Zweiter had been killed, his deep cover was no longer necessary. A Beirut paper published his obituary, signed by several terrorist organizations that mourned Zweiter as one of our best combatants. The leader of the small team that killed Zweiter was an Israeli in his mid-20s, David Molad, not his real name. He was born in Tunisia and emigrated to Israel as a child. From his parents, both teachers and Zionists, he had inherited a perfect mastery of the French language, a profound, deeply emotional love for the State of Israel, and a burning patriotism. Since a young age, he had dreamed of serving Israel, even at the risk of his life. In the army, he had volunteered for an elite commando unit in the IDF and amazed his commanders with his daring and creativity. After his discharge, he had joined the Mossad and had quickly become one of its best agents, participating in the most hazardous operations. Because of his fluent French, he could easily assume the identity of a Frenchman, Belgian, Canadian, or Swiss. He married young and soon became the father of a little boy, but this did not cool his urge to serve on the front lines of the Mossad fighters. After Zweiter's death, Molad spent a few days in Israel, then flew to Paris. A few days later, the phone rang in an apartment on 175 Rue Elysia in Paris. Dr. Mahmoud Hamshari answered the call.
"Is this Dr. Hamshari, the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization representative in France?"
The caller had a strong Italian accent. He introduced himself as an Italian journalist who sympathized with the Palestinian cause and asked to interview Hamshari. They agreed to meet in a cafe far from Hamshari's home. Hamshari, a respected historian who lived in Paris with his French wife, Marie-Claude, and their little daughter, had been taking very strict precautions lately. When walking the streets, he kept watching for people who might be shadowing him. He left cafes and restaurants before his order was filled. He often checked with his neighbors if any strangers had asked about him. On the face of it, he had nothing to worry about. He was an academic, a moderate man, well integrated in the Parisian intellectual circles. "He does not need any precautions," wrote Annie Frankos in the Jeune Afrique Weekly, "because he is not dangerous. The Israeli secret services know that well." But the Israeli secret services knew a few more things. Hamshari's participation in the foiled attempt to assassinate Ben-Gurion in Denmark in 1969, his involvement in the mid-air explosion of a Swiss airliner in 1970 that took the lives of 47 people, his connections with mysterious young Arabs who would sneak into his apartment at night carrying heavy suitcases. The Israeli Secret Services also knew that Hamshari was now the second in command of Black September in Europe. So, on the day Hamshari left for his interview with the Italian reporter, a couple of men broke into his apartment and left 15 minutes later. The following day, the strangers waited until Hamshari's wife and daughter left the apartment and he remained there by himself. The telephone rang and he picked up the receiver. "Dr. Hamshari," the Italian journalist again.
"Yes, speaking."
At that moment, Hamshari heard a shrill whistle, and after it, a thunderous explosion. An explosive charge that had been concealed under his desk blew up, and Hamshari collapsed, gravely wounded. A few days later, he died in the hospital, not before blaming the Mossad for his death. A few weeks after Hamshari's death, Mike Harari and a man named Jonathan Ingleby arrived on the island of Cyprus. They checked into the Olympia Hotel in Nicosia. Lately, because of its location, close to Israel, Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt, Cyprus had become a battlefield between Israeli and Arab agents. This time, the two Israeli agents shadowed a Palestinian by the name of Hussein Abdelhir. A few months before, Abdelhir had been appointed the Black September resident in Cyprus. He was also in charge of relations with the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc nations that had become a paradise and a safe haven for the terrorists. In Russia, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Palestinian terrorists trained in army installations and special forces units. Those countries sent shipments of weapons and equipment for the terrorist organizations. Quite a few Palestinian leaders, enthusiastic believers in the Soviet ideology, studied at the Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow. Abdelhir also was in charge of infiltrating terrorists into Israel and eliminating Arab spies who came to Cyprus to meet their Israeli handlers. The ex-committee sentenced him to death. That night, Abdelhir returned to his hotel room, turned off the lights, and went to bed. Jonathan Ingleby made sure that the man was asleep, then pressed a button on a remote control monitor. A shattering explosion shook the hotel. In a third-floor hotel room, a couple of Israeli honeymooners dived under their bed for protection. The reception clerk rushed to Abdelhir's room. When the smoke cleared, he saw a terrifying scene that made him faint. Abdelhir's bloodied head was facing him, stuck in the lavatory pan. Black September's revenge was instantaneous. On January 26, 1973, an Israeli by the name of Moshe Hanan Ishai met with a Palestinian friend at the Morrison Pub on Jose Antonio Street in Madrid. After they left the pub, two men appeared in front of them and blocked their way. The Palestinian escaped, while the two men drew their weapons, sprayed Ishai with bullets, and vanished. Only a few days later, it was established that Ishai's real name was Baruch Cohen, a veteran Mossad agent who had established a network of Palestinian students in Madrid. The young man he had met at the pub was one of his informants, who actually had been planted in the network by Black September. His comrades avenged Abdelhir's death by taking out Baruch Cohen. Black September was also suspected of shooting and wounding another Israeli agent, Zadok Ofir, in a Brussels cafe, and of assassinating Dr. Ami Shakori, an attaché at the Israeli embassy in London, by a letter bomb. 2 weeks after Abdelhir's death, Black September appointed a new agent in Cyprus. Barely 24 hours after arriving in Nicosia, the Palestinian met with his KGB contact, returned to his hotel, turned off the light, and died in the same way as his predecessor. Arafat and Ali Hassan Salameh decided, therefore, to carry out a massive act of revenge. They planned to hijack a plane, load it with explosives, and have it flown to Israel by a suicide commando. The aircraft would then be crashed in the midst of Tel Aviv, killing hundreds. It was an early version of the 9/11 attack on the Twin Towers in New York. The Mossad informants got wind of the preparations, and several agents started following a group of Palestinians in Paris, who were apparently in charge of the project. One night, the agents noticed an older man who had joined the group. They dispatched the man's photos to Mossad headquarters, and the stranger was identified as Basil Al-Kubaisi, a senior leader of Black September. Kubaisi was a well-known jurist, a law professor at the American University in Beirut, and a respected scholar. But he too, like Zwitter and Hamshari and quite a few others, secretly was a dangerous man. In 1956, he had tried to assassinate Iraq's King Faisal by placing a car bomb on the path of the royal convoy. The bomb exploded prematurely, and Al-Kubaisi escaped to Lebanon and then to the United States. A few years later, he tried to assassinate Golda Meir, who was visiting the United States. When this attempt failed, he tried to murder Meir at the Socialist International Summit in Paris. It was another failure. Al-Kubaisi didn't give up. He joined the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and became the deputy of George Habash, the group's leader. He participated in the planning of the May 30, 1972 massacre, in which innocent passengers in the Lod airport were attacked by Arab and Japanese terrorists. 26 people died in the attack, most of them Puerto Rican pilgrims to the Holy Land. Later, Al-Kubaisi joined Black September, and now he was in Paris, probably to direct the suicide plane operation. He checked into a small hotel on Rue des Arcades, off the Place de la Madeleine. On April 6th, after having dinner at Café de la Paix, Al-Kubaisi was on his way back to his hotel. At the Place de la Madeleine, the Mossad's hit team was waiting. Two people had been placed on the street, two more in a car. One of them was wearing a blonde wig. As Al-Kubaisi came closer, the two agents approached him, cocking their guns. But something unexpected happened. A flashy car stopped next to Al-Kubaisi, and a pretty young woman leaned out of the window. They exchanged a few phrases, and Al-Kubaisi got into the car, which left immediately. The frustrated agents realized that the woman was a prostitute and had just propositioned Al-Kubaisi. The entire operation was going to fail because of a hooker. But the team commander, who was present, calmed his disappointed warriors. "Wait and see," he said knowingly. "She'll bring him back here shortly." They didn't ask how he knew, but the man was right. Barely 20 minutes later, the car was back. Al-Kubaisi parted from the prostitute and started walking toward his hotel. He had only taken a few steps when two men emerged from the shadows, blocking his way. One of them was David Mollad. Al-Kubaisi immediately understood. "No," he shouted in French. "No, don't do that." 9 bullets pierced his body and he collapsed by the Madeleine Church. The Mossad agents jumped in the getaway car and left the square. The following day, as in the Zweiter case, the spokesman of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine revealed the real role of the law professor. In the following months, Mollad and the members of Kidon killed several Black September envoys who had come to Greece to buy ships, load them with explosives, and sail them to Israel's ports. But one question remained unanswered. Where was the mastermind behind Munich? Where was Salamé? Salamé was in his Beirut headquarters, planning his next moves. The first was the takeover of the Israeli embassy in Thailand by a Black September team, but the operation had failed. Threatened by the tough Thai generals and pressured by the Egyptian ambassador in Bangkok, the terrorists released their hostages and left Thailand utterly humiliated. Salamé's next operation was more reckless. His men, armed to the teeth, broke into the Saudi embassy in Khartoum during a farewell party for a European envoy and captured almost the entire diplomatic corps in the Sudanese capital. By Arafat's order, they released most of the hostages and kept only the U.S. ambassador, Cleo A. Noel, the deputy chief of the U.S. mission, George C. Moore, and the Belgian acting ambassador, Guy Ede. Following Salamé's instructions, they murdered them with horrific cruelty, firing first at the feet and legs of their victims, then slowly raising the barrels of their Kalashnikov assault rifles till they ripped open their chests. The terrorists were arrested after the massacre, but released a few weeks later by the Sudanese government. The world reacted with fury and disgust to the appalling assassination of the diplomats. Israel felt that it was time to deal Black September a mortal blow. In Jerusalem, Golda Meir gave the go-ahead to Operation Spring of Youth, A new phase in the ongoing Operation Wrath of God. On April 1, 1973, a 35-year-old Belgian tourist named Gilbert Rambeau checked into the Sands Hotel in Beirut. The same day, another tourist, Dita Altnuda, also checked into the hotel. The two men apparently didn't know each other. Both were given rooms with ocean view. On April 6th, three more tourists arrived in the hotel. The dapper, impeccably dressed Andrew Whichlaw was British. David Molade, who arrived 2 hours later on the Rome flight, produced a Belgian passport in the name of Charles Bussard. George Elder, who arrived in the evening, was British too, but quite the opposite of his fellow countrymen. Another British tourist, Charles Macy, checked into the Atlantic Hotel on El Beida Beach, and like a real Englishman, he inquired twice a day about the weather forecast. Each on his own, the six men toured Beirut, walked the streets, and got familiar with the main traffic arteries. At the Avis and Lenacar agencies, they rented three Buick Skylarks, a Plymouth station wagon, a Valiant, and a Renault 16. On April 9th, a flotilla of nine missile boats and patrol vessels of the Israeli Navy took to the high seas and blended into the international traffic lanes. The MB Miftach carried a paratrooper unit under the command of Colonel Amnon Lipkin, which was to attack the headquarters of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Two other units had embarked on the MB Gash, another paratrooper platoon, and the Sayeret Matkal unit under Colonel Ehud Barak. They had a different mission. Before embarking, each of them had received the photos of four people. Three of them were Abu Yusuf, the supreme commander of Black September, Kamal Adwan, the Fatah top operations commander, who was also in charge of Black September's operations in the Israeli-occupied territories, and Kamal Nasser, Fatah's main spokesman. All three, the soldiers were told, lived in the same apartment building on Rue Verdun. The fourth photo was of Ali Hassan Salame. Nobody knew where he was. The commandos were wearing civilian clothes. At 9:30 p.m., as the boats approached Beirut, they donned wigs and hippie clothes. Ehud Barak put on women's clothes, assuming the appearance of a voluptuous brunette. In his brassiere, he concealed several explosive charges. Out of the dark, several rubber dinghies emerged on the deserted Beirut beach, bringing over the paratroopers from the motherships. In front of them, they saw the six cars, with one of the tourists behind each wheel. Each soldier knew to which car he was assigned. In a matter of minutes, the cars darted in different directions. A few of them turned to the headquarters of the Popular Front. Other vehicles, one of them driven by Molade, headed for the apartment building where the leaders of Black September lived. The military commando unit that headed for the Popular Front headquarters had rehearsed the attack before, using an unfinished building in a Tel Aviv suburb. One night, when Chief of Staff David Dado Elazar had come to watch the training, he had been approached by a young, handsome lieutenant, Avida Shore. "We are going to use 120 kilograms of explosives to bring down the building in Beirut," Avida said. "But this is unnecessary and dangerous. The explosion would affect the neighboring buildings, and there are lots of civilians there." He took a notebook from his pocket. "I made some calculations. We should use only 80 kilograms of explosives. That will bring the building down without harming innocent people in other houses." Elazar had the figures checked and agreed to Shore's suggestion. He instructed the operation commander to use a charge of no more than 80 kilograms. Now, the paratroopers reached the Popular Front headquarters. After a short shootout, in which two Israeli commandos lost their lives, the paratroopers took over the entrance lobby of the building and planted the 80 kilograms of explosives. The explosion turned the building into a heap of ruins, killing scores of terrorists, but not one of the neighboring houses was damaged. one of the commandos killed, was Lieutenant Avida Shore. At the same time, other units of paratroopers and naval commandos attacked several terrorist camps south of Beirut in a diversionary move intended to draw the response of the terrorists and the Lebanese army, but there was no such response. At that very moment, the Sayeret Matkal commandos reached the building on Rue Verdun. They were about to enter when two Lebanese police officers passed by, but all they saw was a pair of lovers tenderly embracing on the sidewalk. The Romeo was none other than Muki Betcher, one of the best Sayeret fighters, and his curvaceous Juliet was Ehud Barak. As soon as the policemen had turned the corner, the Israelis stormed the building. They simultaneously broke into the apartments of Kamal Adwan on the second floor, Kamal Nasser on the third floor, and Abu Yusuf on the sixth.